Hi, I'm Femi Oke. Thank you for watching the stream. At the moment, there is no shortage of political analysis on what is happening in the conflict in Sudan. Two warring generals fighting for control of the country. But on this episode, we are focusing on the people of Sudan. How are they coping, not coping? What is their humanitarian crisis?
Ordinary civilians really have no stake in this conflict at all. They're essentially being used as pawns or as human shields in what is basically and quite literally a personal dispute over power between two generals. They're willing to do anything and everything to win, and that's at the expense of Sudanese civilians. And the result is an absolute humanitarian disaster that, you know, the world can see through their own eyes right now. Personally, the past few days have been pretty difficult, even though I'm not physically in Sudan at the moment. My mother and my siblings are back home in Khartoum, where I grew up. And over the past few days, I've held my breath as I've followed their efforts to evacuate Khartoum.
Joining us to discuss the humanitarian crisis from Khartoum, Al Jazeera English correspondent Heba Morgan. In London, doctor and activist Sarah Abdul-Jalil. And with us from Belfast, Will Carter, Sudan, Country Director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. If you're watching right now and you're on YouTube, you can be part of this conversation as well. How are people managing in Sudan? What are your insights? What's your experience? Put it right here in our comment section. I am curious, guess, what does a ceasefire mean? Are we in a ceasefire situation? Hiba.
Well, we've spoken to some people, and obviously we're in Khartoum, and the answer is no, we're not. You can still hear the sound of the artillery strikes. You can see the fighter jets. They're still launching airstrikes. People still can't leave their homes. They can't access basic necessities. They're still out of water, out of power in many residential areas. And people still don't feel that it's safe for them to go out. There's still armed men, whether it's the rapid support forces on one side or whether it's the Sudanese army on the other side. People don't feel that it's safe enough for them. The idea that when there's a ceasefire, you know, we shouldn't be able to hear the sound of the airstrikes. We shouldn't be able to hear the fighter jets. We shouldn't hear the artillery strikes. We shouldn't be seeing armed men on the streets, you know, setting up checkpoints. And because this is not happening, you can't say that there's a ceasefire, especially when you see plumes of smoke continuing to rise almost all over the capital.
Will, ceasefire for the NRC? Are you in a ceasefire situation? Do you have a little bit of a pause to do some work?
No pauses. I mean, maybe for a few minutes before it's, before it's broken. I mean, these are, you know, political initiatives, but aid needs to reach people regardless of whether there's a ceasefire or not. And, you know, that's not happening at the moment. But yeah, there's airstrikes, there's urban warfare, there's people being displaced, there's ethnic conflict again bubbling in Darfur. But apart from all that conflict, now we've got, you know, essentially states, the market systems are failing. People can't buy bread, food, water's, you know, not being pumped. Two-thirds of hospitals out of action. It's the first crisis of the conflict, and now, you know, essentially a failed state coming to be. But no, I couldn't say that this is a ceasefire where it's operationally allowed. Humanitarians, be them Sudanese or internationals, to respond effectively.
Dr. Sarah, we take for granted that in many parts of the world we can just go to the doctor, or go to a pharmacy, or go to a clinic. But in a situation like we're in right now in Sudan, what are you hearing? What are you seeing regarding medical capabilities for people who are injured, or just regular medical conditions that they need help with?
What's happening in Sudan at the moment is a nightmare. It is, and particularly in certain cities where there is armed conflict. So it is not safe to go for delivering your baby. It may not be safe if you have a heart attack to go to the hospital, or you need an operation for appendectomy. And the risk of being shot is high. There is a risk even if you are staying at home. And therefore, the doctors, my colleagues inside Sudan and outside Sudan, since the 16th of April, we have started to help by telemedicine so that we can provide some support at home for some of the patients that they can stay at home.
Dr. Sarah, I'm going to let you just fix up your earbud because your earbud is also your microphone. I'm going to go over to Heber and then come right back to you. I'm just hearing some horrific stories, Heber, and for people who are even able to get online, things like this. I'm just going to share this that I've seen posted. My family spent so much time arguing about who should escape Khartoum and who should stay with my immobile grandmother. Nobody wanted to leave without the others, that they're now all stuck. What does being stuck mean?
It means being under the sound of constant gunfire. It means not being able to access medical facilities because, again, like Will said, two-thirds of them have been damaged. It means should you need medical assistance for your family, any family member, there is no ambulance. And we're talking about the medical sector that was already in crisis even before this fighting between the two generals. Now it's actually much, much worse. There are no ambulances. There are no supplies in the hospital. One doctor I spoke to says that they're recycling surgical kits because they don't have that anymore and they can't resupply because of the ongoing fighting. They can't access their facilities where they resupply and restock from. So that's what it means, you know, to be stuck. It means you're at home. You can't go to the market because the market has been destroyed. You don't have the cash on hand. Banks have been closed since the start of the fighting. And people were not prepared for this. And you wouldn't be able to move. You can't go to neighboring states if you don't have the money. You need to arrange for an apartment or a house there. And that's not always guaranteed, especially if you don't have cash on hand or in your bank account. People haven't earned their salaries when this fighting started. It means you're immobile. So, you know, you go ahead, Will.
Yeah, it's. I mean, to add to that, it's, you know, families are faced with impossible choices. You know, do we leave under airstrikes and you know, in open warfare to try and, you know, take our chances, but to where? Do we stay and live under, you know, the not just gunfire but heat, no food or water, no power? You know, it's a pretty terrible situation. And Khartoum used to be a place of safety where people came from, you know, from around Sudan, from the, you know, conflicts and Darfurs and other civil wars, and also from other countries. Sudan was very generous. It had over 1 million refugees, most of whom lived in Khartoum. And suddenly it's turned from somewhere which was a bit tense and repressive to somewhere which was, you know, now you know, just a horrific battle scene where nothing is working. So where do you go? You know, so little information, so, you know, few routes to safety. Yeah. It's such a tough situation.
That question about where do you go, where have I seen people from Sudan go? Ethiopia, Chad, Egypt. I just want to share some stories from refugees who went to Chad and what they met there and the situation there. Let's have a look.
There is no security. We fled from Sudan to Chad. We want to be safe. There is no security in Sudan. We came with nothing. We need so many things to survive. We are very tired. We came during Ramadan with no food or water. We rely on UNHCR to take us to safety.
We have no water, no food, no mattresses to sleep. Some of us are sick and need medical attention. We are tired and hungry. We cannot go back because it's not safe. They took everything we have, shot at us and burned houses.
Dr. Sarah, what a dilemma. Stay or go. What choices are members of your family making?
Yes, yeah, so sorry, first of all, about the previous technical issues.
That's okay. We got you back now.
I think, yeah, we are all in a dilemma, with, not just as doctors, but as well about our relatives. Mm. But just going back that, you know, we have been trying to give some advice by WhatsApp for families. Some of them are contacting, you know, me from Gadarif, other from Khartoum, other and from different parts, but mainly from, you know, the area of the conflict. And the questions are very basic. It's questions that they can, you know, have from the primary center, health center, but they can't reach the primary health center. And then comes the problem is where can we get them the medicine? They need paracetamol, they need dialyte. So I need to go back and find where are the community pharmacies that are open. And hopefully with the neighbors, they can share some of the medication. So at the end, when they say to you, thank you, you just feel you want to cry because I've done nothing. But for them, it means a lot because it prevented them from going to the street. My relatives, it's a split. Some of them moved to Al Jazeera in the center. Others are going to the east, and others decided not to leave. And others are going to the north. And at some points, we lost contact with some of our relatives. And we went mad, actually, because we expected the worst, to be honest.
Are you in touch with them, Dr. Sarah? Are you in touch with them now? Did you find them?
So, thanks God, they came back to us. But it is a nightmare. Anything can happen. So today, as I'm speaking to you, some of them are en route, either east or north. And therefore, we are like, you know, sitting and just praying that everything will be fine.
Hiba, go ahead.
Well, Sarah brought up something quite interesting when she said, you know, we rely on neighbors to try to get the basics like medicines, paracetamol. That's one thing that, you know, it gives you a glimmer of hope and it kind of raises your spirits during these dark times, seeing how communities and neighborhoods and, you know, people who you usually just meet on the streets in the morning to say good morning, or maybe during, you know, community events, they've come together in a very impressive way. The little that they have, they try to bring it together to give it to those who need it the most. And I've been quite impressed, you know, when you hear stories of, you know, I was running out of flour and my neighbor gave me a flour to be able to make bread, running out of medicines, and people, you could see it on the internet sharing the medications that they have that they've stopped and saying, this is what we have and this is where I am. If you're nearby and you're in need, come and pick it from me or we'll try to meet up somewhere. There's obviously security risk of leaving your home, but people are trying to break that or challenge that to be able to deliver the basics. And as much as it's quite heartwarming to see that, it's also interesting to see that these people are doing the roles of humanitarian organizations, and it's where the humanitarian organizations need to step up. And we understand, yes, there's security challenges in terms of movement, but to see the neighborhood communities, the small groups of people challenge the security risks and willing to risk their lives to be able to deliver some kind of assistance because they know that there's a person who's desperately in need, that it could be a matter of life and death. It's impressive to see that the youth and the people are coming together to stand with each other during these times.
Will, I want you to pick up off this back of this, but can I play you something first?
Sure.
And it's really a challenge and a question to the humanitarian organisations, picking up from the challenge that Hiba kind of put out there. This is Dahlia. She escaped from Khartoum and ended up in Port Sudan. But she asked a really important question. Here she is. And then Will, immediately off the back of Dahlia, please jump in.
So it's going to be another crisis that no one has envisioned and no one knows how to deal with it. And I think the international community missed a golden chance when they evacuated the foreign nationals, that they could have gotten in some supplies, anything to tide things over. They didn't. So we are left with no security, no hope that these two men will actually cease all clashes or cease all, you know, fighting. And we have no food security. So we're basically left to fend for ourselves with nothing.
Yeah, that's a, it's pretty powerful and bleak, to be frank. I think these criticisms are fair in the sense. I also see the hope that Hiba mentioned. And I've seen Sudanese hospitality care, not just for Sudanese people, but for refugees from other countries. Who they've sheltered and shared food with. And there's been a massive focus on essentially an evacuation effort from much of the international community. I mean, my own organization and other organizations, we haven't left. The majority of our management staff, international staff as well, are still in Sudan, just relocated out of Khartoum. And places such as where Dr. Sarah's family, part of their family is going to in Madani, we're already doing assessments. So we're trying to stay and deliver, at risk staying. We're really worried about, what we can deliver. We can't purchase things from the local market, can't get money in through the banking system. Fuel supplies are out. So it's tough. And, what we really need next is there needs to be a sustainable operation here. It can't be through Khartoum anymore. We have to get supplies and personnel in. And we're also dealing with the fact that it's not just a conflict, but a failing state, a failing market system. So it's tough. And now we need resolve. That some organizations have stayed, for sure they need to step up now, and the international community needs to refocus on how we get this logistically restarted, in a very complex and dangerous operating environment. 5 aid workers were killed in the first few days, and I'm sure many more as well. So it's not straightforward and simple. And we'll see what happens, not just in Khartoum, but in other conflict-affected parts of the country as well. It's not a sudden change that there's been conflict. Darfur has been destabilizing for the last 2 years since the peacekeeping mission had left. We already had 750,000 people displaced from armed conflict newly in the last 2 years or so. So it was getting dangerous, and now it's sort of dropped off a cliff edge, and we have to bring it back up. But I agree. And I'm always marveled by the solidarity of the Sudanese people. But it was vulnerable before, and now they've got nothing really to share, and the systems aren't there around. So, to be honest, we echo the call to get the international community to get their act together. And we're part of that, and we're trying to look at alternative air bridges, try to figure out how to procure and get supplies in. But none of this is simple, fortunately.
If I may, because I've been following Dahlia on her story, and Dahlia is a relative, and understanding where she is talking and where they are settled and where they're moving to. And it was very stressful to hear her story and what's been going on. But at the same time, I think the international community should not be surprised. This is an extension to what's been happening in Darfur. And this year is actually 20 years since the international recognition of what happened in Darfur. And the expectation is they should expect the worst. So we were expecting, as Sudanese diaspora, that these evacuation aircrafts will carry at least medication for the people in Sudan or some sort of aid. And we have reached out. But, nothing has been happened. The evacuation itself for those who are going to leave the country was really very, very stressful and very traumatic for some families, leaving behind some and moving and have to choose and pick. And then, for example, you have doctors who are working in the UK, but they're not British, but because they don't have the nationality. It is just, you feel like the concept of humanity is just lost. Then you move to what's happening in the borders. And for us, we feel like we have to be there for those who are staying and cannot cross the border and feeling sick after a very dangerous journey, and some of them are collapsing there. But how can we do that, and with whom?
These are difficult, dangerous circumstances, really. And I speak to many of our team, including ones that are beginning the response in parts. But it's dire, and we see the destruction in Khartoum. The situation for people who also haven't crossed borders to leave, both residents of Sudan, but also the over 1 million refugees as well. We also see coming back to different camps or having to go back to the same places that they'd fled from. Speaking to some of our teams who have been to Madani and to parts of Jazeera in the last few days and are trying to figure out how to step up despite everything.
Right.
It's bleak. There's just so little there to do. We see schools and buildings with bedding put up, but there's very little food and water. And now the markets are beginning to run thin and cash isn't moving. So it's doubly traumatizing for many people.
All right. So Will and Dr. Tan, I'm just going to take a pause because I want to bring in some other voices into this conversation and then also go to YouTube, Hibba. I've got some questions on YouTube that I know that you'll be able to answer or at least give some insight and some context for our viewers who are watching right now. But first of all, two people from Sudan who helped us kind of build a picture of how people are managing or not managing in this current conflict. Let's have a look.
Many people in Khartoum are still trapped in their homes, having electricity and water problems. Some have had absolutely no electricity or running water in their homes for over a week now. And many people are facing shortages in food supplies because almost all the stores in Khartoum are closed.
Speak for people in Khartoum where there's no access to fuel. A friend just was desperately looking for a solution to get her father to the doctor to find an ambulance, and they couldn't find fuel. And in the end, when they reached the hospital, he passed away.
Hey, but so on YouTube, I've got two comments I want to share with you. This first one is from Rangela, and she says, I flew out of Khartoum on the 7th of April. Would never imagine what happened 1 week later when I saw the Al Jazeera videos of passengers lying down on the airport check-in hall and planes on the tarmac. I could not believe it was the same place I'd walked through a few days earlier. Hiva, you're a journalist, so you believe what you see, you're reporting on it, but you also have family in Sudan. How would you describe these last couple of weeks for you in terms of a reality check?
Because I've been reporting on Sudan and I've been covering the politics along with other stories, we saw the warning signs. We knew it was coming. And I remember I was speaking to my mom, I think it was about 3 days before this happened, and I told her we need to be prepared for something like this. But my mom is a typical Sudanese mom. She just, you know, she downplayed it. She really did. Even when it started fighting, when the fighting started, she really downplayed it. But I haven't seen my family for 12 days. I evacuated my family from Khartoum and I wasn't even able to say goodbye. I don't know when I'm going to be able to see them again. I don't know how long this is going to last. And it's been a reality check in the sense that, you know, we see warning signs, but we don't always necessarily act on it. And I don't know if it's because we have family members who try to assure us and because they're in denial themselves, or maybe because they don't want this to happen. But these past 2 weeks have showed me that, you know, politics is, it's politics, yes, but that having the military involved, you know, the demands of the people when they started this revolution, they said they didn't want the military in the politics. And it kind of, you know, it makes you see why they didn't want that, because this is one of the things that they really feared. But the other thing is, you know, when I look at this past 2 weeks and I look at the solidarity of the people again, it gives you hope that, yes, it's been devastating and it's been really, really hard to look at the streets, the videos of the streets that, you know, we used to drive through and take everything for granted. Those buildings are gone, completely destroyed. You know, facilities, simple facilities like, you know, water and electricity, that was an everyday thing. Now it's very hard to get, right? But then again, like I said, you see the people coming together and you know that rebuilding it may take time, but the people will be able to do it because they have the desire to do so, because they want to come back. For them, like Will said earlier, Khartoum is this place that brought people together, whether you're a displaced person or whether you're looking for better living conditions or whether because you want to stay with a family or better treatment. It may not be the best in the world, but for many people, it was Khartoum. It's the best you can get to, and it's where your family is, and it's where your heart is, and it's the capital, the safest place around the country. And there's hope from many people, despite what they've seen, despite losing family members, despite hearing the airstrikes and the artillery shellings. They still have hope, and that makes me believe that this may last for a while. It's not clear if it's going to last for a short while or a long while, but people will come back and they will rebuild. It won't be easy, but they will be able to do so.
Hiva, Dr. Sarah and Will, thank you for helping us understand the humanitarian crisis so vividly. I want to share something with you, and this is from somebody who fled from Sudan, and as he was fleeing on the bus, somebody stopped by and gave all the passengers juice and hospitality, and this is how they ended their thought here, that as you leave Khartoum, it becomes really, really clear these are the last fields that you'll ever smile at, like they are yours. Just gives you a sense of the pain of seeing your own country, your own home in a conflict situation. Thank you for watching. Thank you for your YouTube comments and questions. The news about Sudan, of course, continues here on Al Jazeera. Take care.